The morning after the CBS News report, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle stated how gravely concerned he was to learn that the president received a warning in August about the threat of hijackers by al-Qaeda. He called for the president's intelligence briefing to be provided without delay to congressional investigators. House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt, a Missouri Democrat, invoked Watergate, saying, "I think what we have to do now is to find out what the president, what the White House, knew about the events leading up to 9/11, when they knew it, and most importantly, what was done about it at that time." But the Democrat who most aroused the ire of the White House and Republicans was New York's Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton. While saying she was not trying to engage in finger-pointing, but simply seeking answers, Clinton rose on the floor of the Senate to declare, "We learned today something we might have learned at least 8 months ago, that President Bush had been informed last year, before September 11th, of a possible al-Qaeda plot to hijack a U.S. airliner." She followed her declaration by holding up the cover of the tabloid New York Post with the glaring headline, "Bush Knew," just below a slightly less glaring 9/11 bombshell. "The president knew what?" Clinton asked. The implication was clear. The president might have had information that could have been used to prevent the 9/11 attacks, yet he did nothing. My White House colleagues and I were incensed. To us, such grandstanding appeared to be a return to the ugly partisan warfare that had come to define Washington and its culture during the 1990s. Politics as war, the innuendo of scandal, and the egregious implication that the president had deliberately neglected the country's safety. It was all in service of the November election results. All the familiar elements were there. The story and the partisan accusations that followed provided great controversy for the media to cover. The storyline would play out for days, and even return 2 years later when the president's highly classified daily intelligence brief referenced in the report would be made available to the public and to the 9/11 commission charged with investigating what had happened. The next day, a front-page story in the New York Times began. After months of unstinting support for President Bush's handling of the war on terror, leading congressional Democrats changed course today and demanded full disclosure of what Mr. Bush was told last summer about the danger of terrorist hijackings. They also called for a broad public inquiry into what the government knew before September 11th. For the first time since September 11th, the bipartisan unity over how Mr. Bush has conducted the war on terror appeared to be dissolving in sharp questions, accusations, and partisan finger-pointing. Democrats, who until now have been reluctant to speak out against Mr. Bush on foreign policy, said it was their duty to seek information. To the White House and its supporters, Clinton's remarks seemed calculated to manipulate the narrative concerning who should be blamed for 9/11, placing blame at the doorstep of the current occupant of the Oval Office. Was she trying to shield the legacy of her husband's presidency by shifting blame for overlooking available intelligence on bin Laden away from him and onto his successor? The White House pointed out that Senator Clinton had not even bothered to call anyone there to find out more about the facts behind the headlines before delivering her speech. To us, the disingenuous way Democratic leaders rushed to create a damning storyline about the president and his administration crossed a line. Republicans objected vehemently and aggressively in a counteroffensive led by the White House. Soon, the same Democratic leaders started stepping back from their initial insinuations and blame-casting, particularly as they realized that their haste to create a narrative involving a terrible tragedy before the facts were known might backfire with the public. But prior to their retreat, the story dominated the news coverage from Washington for several days, and Democrats like Clinton initially fanned the flames of the media feeding frenzy, in part to gain support for the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 9/11 attacks. The White House initially resisted the idea and argued that House and Senate intelligence committees should handle any needed probes. The administration fired back. Vice President Cheney referred to the Democrats' suggestions as incendiary, and President Bush declared, "Had we had any inkling whatsoever that terrorists were about to attack our country, we would have moved heaven and earth to protect America." And in a gesture toward the rapidly vanishing spirit of bipartisanship, he added, "And I'm confident President Clinton would have done the same thing. Any president would have." Is there blame to be doled out here? Maybe so. It would be naive to think Democrats were not seeking political gain just months before the midterm elections. But it would also be wrong to suggest that their over-the-top accusations and partisan finger-pointing were unprovoked and that Democrats alone were responsible for the breakdown in the post-9/11 spirit of bipartisan cooperation. Democrats were responding in part to perceived efforts by Republicans seeking political advantage from the president's aggressive efforts to wage war against Islamic terrorists. And if the shoe had been on the other foot, if a Democrat had been president at the time of the 9/11 attacks, would Republicans in Congress have challenged him in an equally inflammatory fashion? Probably. Republican accusations that President Clinton had wagged the dog in 1998 by launching military strikes against Iraq in order to distract attention from the Monica Lewinsky scandal were likely just as partisan. The problem in Washington is systemic and transcends the personal flaws of any single politician. In truth, the breakdown in bipartisanship was bound to happen, given that suspicion and distrust between the two parties and their leaders in Washington had become so deeply rooted in the destructive climate of the preceding decade. Blaming one party or suggesting that certain leaders or individuals are solely responsible for the divisiveness only makes the situation worse, tempting us to ignore the root causes of how we got to this point in our national political discourse. Getting to the truth beyond the continual partisan sniping has become increasingly difficult for ordinary Americans. Partisans in Washington have become very sophisticated in the ways they murk it up with partial truths, political spin, misrepresentations, distortion, and an overall lack of intellectual honesty. And the media too often focus on who is winning and who is losing the latest skirmishes in the ongoing campaign rather than on the substantive issues involved and their effects on the lives of Americans. But getting to the reasons why Washington is broken and dominated by partisan warfare and the culture of deception it spawns is not so difficult a task. Once people recognize that the problem with Washington is not the domain of one party or its leaders, but rather a problem that afflicts both parties and their leaders, then we can begin to move beyond it and get Washington back on track to solving our most important challenges as a nation and avoid some of the more destructive consequences of today's political hostility and verbal combat. Some political observers, especially Democrats, blame Karl Rove for many of the excesses that characterized the era of the permanent campaign. Karl is a gifted, powerful practitioner of contemporary political warfare. But Karl Rove is not the problem. Karl Rove did not create the excesses of the permanent campaign. All you have to do is look back at the campaigns run by people like Lee Atwater, James Carville, and other past political masters to see that. Rather, the excesses of the permanent campaign created Karl Rove. However, no political operative before Rove arguably had so much influence within a White House. As senior advisor overseeing political affairs and strategy, Rove controlled an inordinately influential power center in the White House. There were other influential power centers, but none had as much impact on White House governing, policy, and operations. Unlike Karen Hughes, whose goal was to help the president shape his message in ways that would appeal to ordinary Americans, particularly those in the vital center, and unlike Andy Card, the chief of staff who served as an honest broker among various political points of view, Rove was a central player who was anything but neutral in his political and ideological views. Rove's role was political manipulation, plain and simple, which explains the machinations within the White House and their consequences, whether beneficial or detrimental. As for the truth behind the accusations that Bush knew, it would take many months to sort out what had really happened in the months leading up to 9/11. The president's daily briefing, it would be learned in 2004, was based on the same intelligence reporting President Clinton received in the 90s. Unfortunately, the initial response of the Bush White House to demands by partisan critics in Congress and elsewhere for an independent investigation fueled the firestorm of anger. It was an early indication that the Bush administration did not sufficiently accept the necessity for transparency in its management of the public business. The president and his senior advisors had little appetite for outside investigations. They resisted openness and believed that investigations simply meant close scrutiny of things they would prefer to keep confidential. Not that anything they'd done had necessarily crossed a legal line. Rather, some things done privately might not look so good if disclosed publicly and might cause political embarrassment for the president. Keeping the curtains closed and doors locked is never a good idea in government, unless it involves vital matters of national security. Secrecy only encourages people to do things they would prefer others not know about. Openness is critical for accountability. The Bush administration lacked real accountability in large part because Bush himself did not embrace openness or government in the sunshine. His belief in secrecy and compartmentalization was activated when controversy began to stir. That secrecy ended up delaying, but not preventing, the consequences. Resistance to openness in times of controversy is ultimately self-defeating in the age of the internet, blogosphere, and today's heightened media scrutiny. Andy Carr knew from his service in two previous administrations that investigations have a way of taking on lives of their own. Control was something the White House always wanted, the more the better. But given the partisan nature of Washington, once a narrative had liftoff, it was hard to bring back to earth. Although the Bush White House was never willing to lead the charge in pursuit of potentially unflattering truths, the administration eventually concluded that an investigation of events leading up to the September 11th tragedy was inevitable. And so, in November 2002, the 9/11 Commission was born as an impartial, bipartisan effort at transcending political warfare and uncovering the truth.